This is the Afternoon Magazine on AM 580 and online at WILL.UIUC.EDU. Good afternoon, I'm Celeste Quinn. Thanks for tuning in today. One of the arrows in the quiver of psychiatry is electroconvulsive therapy. For many, ECT conjures up grisly images, and although it has been refined, it remains controversial. But proponents say ECT can save lives, offering hope in cases where other treatments have failed. On the program today, we'll take a look at ECT. We'll talk about its potential and its risks. Two guests join us this afternoon. They are Kitty Dukakis and journalist Larry Tai. They are the authors of the book Shock, The Healing Power of Electroconvulsive Therapy. In 2001, Kitty Dukakis started ECT treatment. She had suffered for many years from severe depression and drug and alcohol addiction, struggles she revealed in her 1990 memoir, Now You Know. Kitty Dukakis is the wife of former Massachusetts governor and 1988 Democratic presidential nominee Michael Dukakis. Her story, her experience with ECT, is half the story of the book, Shock. Larry Tai is a journalist who worked for the Boston Globe for 15 years. His primary beat was medicine. He has taught journalism at Boston University, Northeastern, Tufts, and Harvard. He's the author of three previous books. In this book, Larry Tai looks at ECT's history and its effects. He interviewed researchers and practitioners for the book. He also interviewed people who had undergone ECT about their experiences with it. He says their experiences ranged from life-sustaining to personality-obliterating. Listeners, your questions and comments are invited. You can join us with a telephone call. The number in the Champaign-Urbana area is 333-9455. That's 333-WILL. Anywhere else, call toll-free 800-222-9455. 800-222-WILL. Kitty Dukakis, Larry Tai, thank you so much for joining us this afternoon.
Nice to be with you.
Nice to talk with the two of you. Kitty Dukakis, how did you make the decision that you would be treated with ECT?
Well, I was at that point quite desperate. I had tried a very long list of antidepressants that worked, if they did at all, for very short periods of time, and nothing seemed to be helping me.
What was your depression like?
Well, it was what is called clinical depression. I call it a dark hole, a deep hole, in which I felt unable to do the kinds of things that make life worth living.
Yeah. You write in the book that when you're sad, you cry, but with depression, you can't cry.
Right. And that's, it takes away, it, for me, it took away feelings and the very strong ambitions I have for all kinds of projects, and made me not a full person.
Yeah. Well, here let me mention that you're a social worker, a founding member of the U.S. Holocaust Memorial Council, an advocate for programs to battle homelessness and promote refugee rights. And you're a wife and mom and very full life.
Right.
Yeah. You know, the depression was debilitating, yet you hit it, and you hit it pretty well. Is that common?
Well, I think most people who suffer with the kind of depression I had, which is called clinical depression, are able a lot of the time to hide what is a very painful, personal kind of addiction. And so as a result, I was able to move through it at times, and at other times I couldn't, and I was in my bed or doing things that I shouldn't have done that were very dangerous.
Yeah. Did your public roles in your husband's political career affect, complicate the situation?
No. First of all, this kind of depression isn't based on any kind of event in one's life. It's happens, and it happens for no apparent reason, so one can't blame a life event on it. And so as a result, it wasn't my husband's campaigning or his holding office that affected my campaigns. What happened was that with my alcoholism, for example, I did not have anonymity because the press found out about it and reported it. And as a result, that was difficult.
Yeah.
But that's part of the reality for public people and people who are spouses of politicians.
Yeah. Larry Tye, in this book, Kitty says she was the perfect patient for ECT. When is ECT likely to be recommended and for whom?
It's likely to be recommended for people with depression who have the kind of depression that Kitty had, which is a chemically or biologically based depression, not one that comes from having lost a loved one or having gone through some single traumatic event. So she was the perfect candidate in terms of having had depression, also having run through the range of alternative treatments. She tried talk therapy, she tried single antidepressants, and she tried combinations of antidepressants. And ECT is generally used today as a treatment of last resort because it is a medical procedure that does require anesthesia. Anybody who had a choice would clearly prefer to sit down and talk about their problems or to pop a pill and deal with the depression that way. She had run through those treatments. Nothing else had worked. She was in a situation of really needing to try something new. Her kind of depression was the perfect kind for ECT, and so she made the ideal patient.
Yeah. You say in the book, Larry, that ECT is not a cure, but it can offer relief and even remission. How long can the relief and or remission last?
It can last a matter of weeks for most people, at which point they either need to find an antidepressant or another drug treatment that will work for them, or they have to go on some sort of a schedule of ongoing ECT, getting it maybe once every couple weeks to start with, then once a month. So for most people, their depression would come back in a matter of weeks. For Kitty, her relief lasts as long as 8 months. She cycles through depression every 8 months or so. ECT gives her extraordinary relief. After 5 or 6 treatments over the course of 2 weeks, she is good, generally, for a long period of time. So it depends on everybody's individual cycle with depression. But again, for most people, the same way, if they were to go off their antidepressants, the depression would come back. If they go off ECT and do nothing else, the depression generally comes back pretty quickly.
I think there's another point that I have met many people who just had to go through a six-treatment period with 3 treatments a week, which is what I have, and never cycled again, never had depression again. So there are some people, I mean, what this shows is that we're all very different and that our chemistry, our mental chemistry, our brain chemistry is very different.
Mm. Would you tell us how the procedure is administered?
Well, I go in at about 6:45 in the morning, and I'm out by 9:15. Patients are told not to drive on the days that they have treatment, and I listen to that because of the anesthesia. I often drive after treatment, you know, the days in between. And when I have treatment, I have an EKG before and during the treatment. All of my body functions are checked. I am given a relaxant, and then I am put to sleep with oxygen.
Let me tell you a couple things that the Kitty is put to sleep during the treatment like all patients are. Let me talk about a few things that I could see when she was getting treatment that she wasn't aware of. In terms of what actually happens with the treatment, 2 electrodes are put on the head, and with the kind of treatment that most people get today as the first course and the kinds that Kitty gets all the time, the 2 electrodes are put on the same side of the head, what's called unilateral treatment, to try to minimize the potential for memory loss. Then electricity, enough to come close to igniting a 60-watt light bulb, is shot through the brain. And I had expected, having watched the movie One Flew Over the Cuckoo's Nest mm-hmm. and read all these books about the treatment, that she'd levitate off the table, or that at a minimum, her body would go through a violent convulsion. In fact, the only sign that she was having a seizure, a grand mal, a big seizure, was that one toe slightly lifted up and came down. And it all happened so quickly that I realized that the second hand on the watch that I was using to try to time it was much too fast to really get a sense of what was going on. This happens in a matter of seconds. She's out from the time that she gets her her anesthesia and her muscle relaxant to the time that she wakes up after the procedure is 15 minutes. So that's the time that everything happens and that she gets a chance to wake up, but the seizure itself is a matter of seconds.
How has this treatment changed over the years, Larry?
As much as any single medical treatment that I can think of, it's been revolutionized. And it was revolutionized, ironically, before the book One Flew Over the Cuckoo's Nest was written, and certainly long before the movie was made based on that book, to the extent that anesthesia is given, so the patient is out long before the treatment starts, muscle relaxant is given so that there are no violent reactions to the convulsion, oxygen is administered so that it minimizes the chance of any brain impact, and it's done on one side of the head to minimize memory loss. It's done with less electricity for a shorter period of time than it was done historically. So all of these are ways to do two things. One is to reduce the risk to the patient of any medical complications, to maximize the potential for the effectiveness of the treatment, and to minimize, although it can't eliminate, the chance of memories being lost.
Mm. How did it affect you, Kitty?
Well, I had, and I've heard this story repeated with others, though the usual is that people within four or five treatments begin to feel a difference. And it is a couple of weeks usually after that that they are back into feeling very full lives without depression. And in the case of my first treatment, I began feeling a result right away. Mm-hmm. I smiled when I woke up, which surprised my husband since I wasn't in a very smiling mood prior to that time. And I wanted to go out for dinner that night. It was our anniversary, and told him on the way home that that's what I wanted to do, and we did that. Oftentimes, I'll have events the day of my treatment, and I can, although I'm not as clear-headed as I am at other times, I certainly am able to carry on with social and other functions.
Yeah.
Celeste, let me say one more thing. We've been talking about depression.
Uh-huh.
ECT can help with depression. It can help with mania. It can help with the alteration between depression and mania called bipolar disorder. It can help with everything from schizophrenia to catatonia. There are very few serious mental illnesses where it's not at least worth considering it because it can help. So it's really... The standard way of talking about it is as a treatment for depression because that is the most prevalent among the mental illnesses. But in fact, it's out there for a wide range of illnesses.
Is it used for addiction?
No. No, it is not. However...
It's used for addiction, but Kitty can tell you... Yeah, go on.
The however is that when one has depression, for many people, there is a likelihood that alcohol will... be used as a way of blotting out the pain. And for those who are alcoholics, it's a very dangerous situation. There are some alcoholics who have depression. There are lots of people who have depression who are not alcoholic. I was one of the unlucky ones. And so I say that on the one hand. On the other hand, I have been blessed with extraordinary friendships in the fellowship, and that is helped by my feeling well most of the time. The other point is that I have a sense of hope today that I never had before. I always was waiting for the other shoe to drop, as the saying goes, and this just doesn't happen now. I feel the depression coming on. I don't wait a very long period of time and go in and have the treatment, and that's a big plus in my life today.
And Larry Tye, is Kitty's story typical?
Kitty's story is typical in a lot of ways. It's typical in the sense that addiction is often, as she said, accompanied by depression. And with ECT as a treatment in dealing with the depression, it can make whatever the other condition is sometimes much easier to deal with. I was reading today in the newspaper about how diabetes, in an extraordinary percent of people, 25 to 35% of people, diabetes is accompanied by depression. And if you can eliminate the depression that goes with so many other conditions, With ECT or with other treatments, it makes the others easier to deal with. Where Kitty's is also typical in terms of the memory loss that she suffers generally being only short-term and having to do with a period right around the treatment. There are people who suffer longer-term memory issues and who find that their ECT really was something they would never go through again. But I interviewed more than 100 patients, and I found the Kitty's experience of being willing to tolerate whatever limited memory loss there is in return for getting rid of the depression was a lot more typical than I thought it was going to be. And so that was why we would write every other chapter her first-person experience and then my trying to look at whether her experience was generalizable.
Yeah. How do you deal with the memory loss?
Well, first of all, the short-term memory loss, I do certain things in preparation. I have pieces of paper next to my bed, a list of all of the telephone numbers of people I want to call, my sister, my children, my husband, and friends. And I also, when I'm driving, since I know that my memory may be a little bit impaired, I go through the traffic that I'm going to be in or the route that I'm going to be taking very carefully before I go out during that time. Mm-hmm. And those are small trade-offs. That really doesn't take very much time, and I'm able to continue and carry on with my work.
And also, correct me if I'm wrong, but in the book, don't you write that the memory loss, the short-term memory loss, has become less severe, if I could use that word, over the years?
Yes, it has.
Yeah.
That's absolutely correct. And I think I've learned how to deal with it better. There are some memory losses that I've had that are longer term, and most of them are not cognitive, but have to do with trips that we've taken. I talk in the book about a trip to Paris that we took together, and I have no memory of that first trip. We went back 4 years later and stayed in the same hotel, and I just had no memory of any of the sites that we visited in Paris.
Mm. That "we," by the way, is not Kitty and me. It's Michael and
Kitty. Right.
Now, Larry, memory loss. Some people would say, well, that's brain damage.
They would. And defining what brain damage is a really difficult thing. And in the book, basically, I said that any scientific studies that have been done don't seem to show brain damage. Now, is it brain damage when people take an antidepressant and they either have a memory loss because of the antidepressant or they have difficulties with their libido or whatever the complications are? There are side effects. Whether it's damage or not is a matter of semantics. The fact is that the same way antidepressants and antipsychotics and every psychopharmaceutical that's out there comes with potential side effects, so does ECT. Is it fixing the brain? Is it damaging the brain? I don't think that most people that I talk to who are seriously facing mental illness don't quite care about the semantics. They care about whether they feel better and whether the illness lifts. And ECT, while it doesn't work for everybody, works for a higher percent of people than any competing treatment out there. And it's not me saying that. It's the Surgeon General and the National Institutes of Health. They say that ECT works, on average, for about 75% of the people who are administered it, which is about 10 or 15% higher than the best of the drugs that are out there as an alternative.
Why does it work for 75%?
Well, that's a great question, and the answer is I could give you 5 scientific theories that have everything to do with its anticonvulsant, ironically an anticonvulsant effect, to the way it affects neurotransmitters the same way SSRI, the new generation of antidepressants, does. But in fact, nobody really knows about the science, the same way they don't know the science of why an antidepressant works. My 2 favorite theories are the ones that patients give me. And for the over 50 patients, they compare getting ECT to what they used to do when they had an old TV set that had lines and became fuzzy, and they'd go by and kick the TV set, and suddenly the fuzziness would disappear and they'd get a clear picture. And they say that's the effect that ECT has on them. for younger people who get cable TV, who never had to experience fuzzy TV sets, they compare it to rebooting a computer. When something goes wrong with your computer, a lot of the time, if you just turn it off and turn it back on again, magically it's fixed. And they say that's, again, what it feels like. They feel like their brain is somehow being rebooted. So whether it's kicking a fuzzy TV or rebooting a computer, most of the people that I talk to who have had ECTs say, we don't care why it works. We care that it works.
People that you talk to who had a bad experience, what did they tell you about their experience?
They tell me there are some people, there are two different groups of people with a bad experience. There are the ones who say it was a nightmare, and some of them have become sort of permanent critics of ECT, and they say, we think the procedure shouldn't be around anymore. More often, and more surprising to me, are the people who are like Ann Donahue, the state legislator in Vermont that I interviewed, and she had an experience where she had the kind of ECT, not like what Kitty had, but she had the kind called bilateral, where the electrodes are on either side of the brain. It had a serious effect in impairing her memory going back 6 or 7 years, and she feels like a chunk of her life is missing. On the other hand, she says she would not be alive today if it weren't for the ECT. So does she wish that it impaired fewer memories? Yes. Does she wish that she had had unilateral, like Kitty did, on just one side of the head? Yes. Would she, if she had to do it over again, have ECT again? Yes, is her answer. And a surprising number of people who suffered serious memory loss say it was a choice for many of them of giving in to the impulse of suicide or losing memories, and that's an easy choice.
Hmm. What if it affects a part of who you are? And maybe Kitty can talk about this too. There was a writer in the book, a Pulitzer Prize winning writer who had ECT, and I believe it was the second round of treatments. It destroyed or it affected his ability to write, to his narrative style.
Right. I'm sure that's true in
his Kitty's
case.
Friend,
in my case, it just has never happened that way, so that I really can't address that from my own perspective.
Right.
It just hasn't happened.
The writer you're speaking of happens to be a friend of Kitty's, who's William Styron, the Pulitzer Prize-winning author of Sophie's Choice and other great books. And the first time around, as you say, Celeste, it worked well. The second time around, it didn't. When I talked to his wife about it, she said, look, we wish it had worked both times, and it did rob him of some things. But, again, the first time around, it helped keep him alive. And I think that people have to make a decision. We're not out there writing this book advocating that people have ECT. We are out there advocating that if they want it, it should be available, and that they should not face a stigma. It's enough of a stigma dealing with mental illness, and people should not face a second stigma for the choice of treatment that they make.
Yeah. Kitty Dukakis, is this why you've written this?
Yes, worked on this? My hope was that we might be able to destigmatize a treatment that is very effective for many large numbers of people, and also to open the way for those who are desperate. Both Larry and I receive letters often from people who had attempted suicide and for whom this treatment has been a miracle.
And also, what's your sense, the two of you, in terms of where we are today in blasting away the stigma that is so often attached to depression?
I think we're further ahead. I think we have a long way to go. There are many people who don't understand what clinical depression is. They understand when people go through difficult times, when they, as Larry said, either lose a loved one or have a crisis in their lives. This is a very different kind of depression, and it is chemical, and it alters the way we are able to go on with our daily lives.
And for the progress that we've made in the last 10, 20 years in terms of reducing this stigma of depression, we've also done a brilliant job, I think, in society of reducing The stigma of taking antidepressants, people understand that it's an illness, that you should take a treatment. It was, to borrow a bad word, shocking to me how much the stigma remains for electric shock. And it's like it's okay to have a disease, it's okay to treat it any way but this way. And the idea that the most effective treatment out there is also potentially the most controversial in all of medicine just seems like a disconnect, and that's what this book was all about, trying to say, look, it can work, it can help you, and look at it as you would any medical treatment, but not forget about the image from the cuckoo's nest, because that's not what ECT is.
I think the other thing is that there are huge numbers of people, millions of people, who suffer in this country from clinical depression, and only 100,000 have this treatment annually. It's a tiny percentage of those people who are suffering.
Hmm. How many people are treated with ECT in the U.S. annually?
100,000.
100,000 in America, a million worldwide. But as Kitty says, if you start with this universe of somewhere between 20 and 40 million people who suffer from depression, and you say that some 20 to 40% of them are not going to be helped by antidepressants, you've got a group of 5 million or so people out there who potentially could benefit from another treatment like ECT. And so while 100,000 sounds like a lot, when you look at these people who have nothing working for them, and that's just with depression, not talking about the other illnesses, there's a real disconnect. And we think that if people understood how this treatment worked, that potentially a lot more of them could be helped by just considering it.
Mm-hmm. This is The Afternoon Magazine. Our guests this afternoon are Kitty Dukakis and journalist Larry Tai. They are the co-authors of Shock, The Healing Power of Electroconvulsive Therapy. My name is Celeste Quinn. Listeners, I invite you to join us this afternoon with questions, comments. You can join the discussion with a telephone call. The number in the Champaign-Urbana area, 333-9455. That's 333-WILL. Anywhere else, call toll-free, 800-222-9455, 800-222-WILL. You note in the book that electric shock nearly vanished with the lobotomy and the insulin coma, but it is making a comeback. It has made a comeback. Why?
It made a comeback. It was developed first in Italy 70 years ago, brought to the United States. And the idea with the stigma and the idea with all of these alternative drug treatments out there, in the late 1960s and early 70s, ECT almost vanished. It came back, I think, for two simple reasons. One is because it worked, and two is because so many people continued suffering despite all the drugs out there because they didn't work for a lot of people. So it was needed, it was available. And despite all this sense of its image being barbaric and torturous, it was just too effective to be tossed away. And I think that that's one of the encouraging things about ECT, that whereas most drugs have been out there for 10, 20, 30 years, and we don't have a real long-term sense of how they work, ECT has been around for 70 years, and we have a very good sense of its effect over a very long period of time.
Let's take a call. A listener in Terre Haute on line 4. Hi. Is there a caller there? Line 4? Doesn't sound like it. We'll try again in a second. This is The Afternoon Magazine. If you'd like to talk with our guests, Larry Tai and Kitty Dukakis, 333-9455, the number in the Champaign-Urbana area. Anywhere else, toll-free, 800-222-9455. Well, what's the experience of places elsewhere in the world? Larry, you said a million worldwide.
A million worldwide. The experience is that in some parts of the world, like in Scandinavia, the stigma seems to have been largely dissolved. They understand that it works. They are a very advanced society in terms of their use of medicine generally, and there is not the opposition, so it's widely used without much controversy. In other parts of the world, it's very controversial. In Germany, there are still all these fears left over from the Holocaust-era medical experiments that have made it the society more reluctant to try anything that has controversy in terms of a medical treatment. And so it varies. In China, it's starting to be very widely used. It's not an especially expensive form of treatment, and it's something that can be administered relatively easily. And so it country by country varies everywhere around the world.
Hmm. You write in the book that more can be done and more is being done to limit memory loss. What's being done? What else should be done?
Well, I think, first of all, the amount of electricity one is given is much, as Larry had mentioned earlier, is much less than it ever was before. The other piece is having unilateral on one side of the brain treatment. And doctors are constantly, there is research going on all over the country, and people are working on ways in which the memory issue can be improved.
Larry, did you want to add anything?
Yes, I think that that they're perpetually fine-tuning this with everything from the amount of electricity to the area in the brain that it's located on. They're even trying out using magnetic forms of treatment where they don't have to induce a shock and they don't have to use electricity. There are very exciting experiments, and the trend is to increasing the effectiveness while minimizing memory loss. But the fact is today we're still stuck with the conundrum that people have to understand that there is a risk of memory loss. Ideally, someday we'll have a treatment that goes exactly to the right part of the brain without interfering with anything else. Today it's a trade-off, and to most patients that I talk to, it was a trade-off where the benefits to them outweighed the risk.
Mm. Speaking of risk, I found a couple of things troubling. A review, this is from the book, Shock. A review of New York area hospitals by researchers at Columbia found that some facilities take steps to limit and measure memory loss, but others do not.
That's something that Kitty and I have both been very distressed about, and one of the things the book was trying to be is a bit of a clarion call to say to the medical profession, get your act together. Get your act together in doing a better job of training ECT doctors. Today it's generally they watch a couple patients getting shock treatment and then they administer it themselves. So the medical and the psychiatric profession have to do a better job. They also have to ensure that where you go, the same way if you get an open heart surgery in one hospital versus another, you presume that they're all up to a certain standard. With ECT, even in the Boston area, which is one of the medical meccas in America, we see that it depends hospital by hospital where you go to in terms of how sensitive the staff are in using the latest techniques to increase effect and minimize loss. And it just, there's a kind of variation that you see in almost no other medical procedures, and this is partly because ECT has been discussed in whispers within the psychiatric world as well as in the general public, that people are reluctant to say that they're ECT doctors, shock doctors, because of the stigma associated with that. And by removing the stigma, we hope to encourage an increase in the training and the quality of programs around the country.
What do doctors say behind closed doors?
It's the best-kept secret in psychiatry that among psychiatrists that I talk to, I'm always hearing, oh, we know ECT is great and that it has a better chance of working, but we're afraid to recommend it to our patients because we know their reaction will be, geez, that treatment, we thought that went out the door, you know, half a century ago. And so they are subject to these same stereotypes of the treatment that the general public is, but within the profession, they all seem to know that ECT is out there. When nothing else works, that it often can.
They also know that ECT can be a life-saving treatment for certain categories of people. And we've both mentioned suicide. For people who are suicidal, this is a treatment that works much more quickly. For pregnant women who cannot, for example, who are bipolar and cannot take the medicine because it might affect the fetus, oftentimes ECT is used. And for the elderly who are on a variety of drugs very often, and this is one that will not interfere with their other drug usage.
Let's take a call now. Listener in Champaign on line one. Hi.
Hi. It's an interesting program. 50 years ago, I worked in a sanitarium, and I used to have to attend those electric shock treatments, and it took four of us to hold the patient down on the table, and it was always bipolar, and the shock levels, I guess, were much higher then, and it was kind of interesting. We would have to sit with the patient while they came out of it, and the first thing they'd ask is, where am I? What day is it? You know, they just lost everything, almost, and they would gradually get back into it. But I'm pleased to see that they've sort of done some research and taken turned down the dosage of shock with those things. And incidentally, the one flew over the cuckoo's nest. Har wasn't the ECT. It was the lobotomy they gave Jack Nicholson at the end.
That's correct.
Yeah.
Can I say a couple things? The caller's exactly right in terms of saying that was what the treatment looked like. I had more people describe to me working in ECT clinics 50 years ago where the way of controlling the convulsion, the effect on the patient, was having people physically hold down the patient. The good news is today that the combination of the muscle relaxant and the anesthesia, that's not necessary, that the sign of the convulsion is generally a twitch rather than a jolt that can cause fractures, but that also, that you're exactly right about cuckoo's nest. The problem was, in the book, it was made clear that at the end, Jack Nicholson became a vegetable because of a lobotomy.
In
the movie, it never said the word lobotomy, and you looked at him, and unless you noticed the little cut in his forehead, you thought that was more ECT.
Yeah, going back to the 50s when I took part in those things, I remember they would administer a drug called Avapol, which I think was a Curare derivative.
Yes, it was. It was scary, and that Curare could often harm the patient more than the ECT did.
Right, and even in spite of that, I would see jaw dislocated, a collarbone would pop, and the doctor would tell me, now this guy's going to complain of a sore jaw tomorrow. You don't know anything about it.
very different today.
I'm glad to hear that. Well, thanks a lot for taking my call.
Thank you.
Next, we talk with a listener in Urbana on line two. Hi.
Hi. Yes, first I want to say thank you for this program. It couldn't have been come at a better time. I'm currently going through ECT. I've had six. I'm going to have my seventh one tomorrow. I guess I'm kind of a little full of anxiety and yet to know how this is going to come out. I do have a question about when do you know enough is enough, or what would be the main positive difference a person would notice when he's getting better?
You want to take that first, Larry?
Sure. The sense of enough is enough, it varies. Some people, like Kitty, as few as five treatments start showing, or as few as a couple start showing positive effects. Others have to go through seven, eight, nine. It varies. I'm not a doctor, and I would hate to tell you when to look for or when to be discouraged by the signs. I would say, working with your doctor on it, have you seen any hopeful effect yet?
I have kind of on the depression side. I also suffer from anxiety disorder and ADD. Plus, like Kitty, I am a recovered alcoholic, had narcotic problems along with it. I have what my doctor is, I feel very comfortable with. He's a specialist in the area. I lost my train of thought here.
That happens when, believe me, I know that.
My sense is that the positive effect you're likely to see with it is not on the anxiety end, but on the depression end, and it sounds like you're already seeing that ECT can help with the depression that often goes with the anxiety disorder, that can be very helpful, but the...
I've had people... I feel a little more comfortable. You know, I've had people tell me that, you know, I look better, feel better, you know, act better.
Yeah, and you've just said something that oftentimes both Larry and I hear, that often it is the patient's friends or associates or other doctors who are able to see the results of ECT faster than the patient himself or herself.
Well, that was a question I had, too. I have a little memory loss, and I guess I'm concerned about that. I'm currently getting bilateral on the doctor's recommendation. He thinks it works better, but, you know, I definitely picked up on what you folks talked about unilateral.
I would ask your doctor about it, and I think every patient has a right to ask those questions often.
Okay. Well, I want to say it's a privilege to talk to you folks.
Can I offer one thing? If it were to help for you or for anybody listening, we have an email address associated with the book that we're not doctors, we're not pretending to be able to advise people, but if they want to find out more about some of the things that we know, one thing to do is obviously check out the book. Another is the email address is very simple. It's ectbook, ectbook as one word, at AOL.com. But we wish you great luck with this, and it sounds like you're already having some noticeable effect that you're seeing and that, more importantly, other people around you who care about you are seeing.
Well, I'm hopeful.
Great.
I guess that, I have a little bit of a kind of a tired, lazy feeling a little bit. I don't know if that's...
I am tired the day I have treatment, and that's to be expected. And the surge of energy usually comes toward the end of my treatment, and sometimes even a week later.
Yeah, and it's interesting, Kitty, you say that you kind of get revved up.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm. And that's because when you've come out of a deep depression, oftentimes one wants to make up for all of those down times, and so you tend to charge the motor a little too hard, and I'm learning how not to do that, but it's difficult for very active people.
Yeah, I want to thank the gentleman from Urbana for calling in and talking with.
Lots of good luck to him.
Yeah, and before we're out of time, I've got one more call to take. A listener on line one, hi.
Hi, you're talking about ECT, which I believe you said required general anesthesia. I thought that in itself could cause memory loss, and is there any attempt to, is it absolutely necessary to have a general to do this? Thank you.
Okay.
The answer is yes, it's necessary to have anesthesia. The anesthesia is, nobody wants to have anesthesia, and there are a couple things that can cause memory loss. It can be associated with anesthesia. It can be associated with the underlying depression that often causes memory loss. So it's sometimes difficult to separate out what is a result of the ECT, what's a result of the anesthesia or the depression. Yes, it would be nice if you didn't need anesthesia, and yet both so that you won't feel anything and so that you won't remember anything about the treatment, anesthesia is felt today to be a necessity.
And it's also very short-acting anesthesia.
Yes, 15 minutes from beginning to total wake-up.
Okay. Well, there we'll leave it. We're out of time. I have a call I can't take this afternoon, I'm sorry to say. But I want to thank the two of you very much for joining us this afternoon and talking with our listeners.
Glad to be with you.
Kitty Dukakis and journalist Larry Tai are the co-authors of the book Shock, The Healing Power of Electroconvulsive Therapy. The book is published by Avery, which is a member of the Penguin Group. And again, let me give you the email address if you'd like to get in touch with our guests, ectbook, all one word, at AOL.com. And we'll put that up on our website here at WILL.